Is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2004 lecture series presents Reinventing the Wheel, Original Capitalism in Dracula Land, by National Public Radio commentator Andre Codrescu, on Monday, March 8th at 7:30 p.m. in the auditorium of Smith Memorial Hall, 805 South Matthews Avenue, Urbana, on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Today, in this portion of the program, a family story involving a journalist, his wife, and the orphan girl who became their daughter. The father and mother are Neely and Vita Tucker. Their daughter is Chipo. Her name in the Shona language means gift. Shona is the language spoken by the majority of Zimbabweans. The Tuckers, newly married, went to live in Zimbabwe in 1997. Neely Tucker was a foreign correspondent covering Africa for the Detroit Free Press. While living in Harare, the Tuckers began volunteering at an orphanage. That's where they first saw Chipo. When Neely and Vita first saw her, she was 3 months old, but looked like a newborn. She was critically ill. Today, she's a healthy, happy little girl. Neely Tucker has written a memoir about this family story. He calls it a family memoir. The title of the book is Love in the Driest Season. It is about love and transformation. This is from the book's prologue. There are moments in life, no more than two or three, when everything changes and you find yourself swept along in a series of events that are beyond your measure. And so it was that I picked up the girl child one day in an orphanage at the epicenter of the world's AIDS crisis in a country where foreign journalists, including myself, would shortly be declared to be enemies of the state. She regarded me with worried eyes and a whimper, and then she closed her left hand around my little finger. Listeners, you're invited to join the conversation with your questions and comments. If you're listening in the Champaign-Urbana area, the number is 333-9455. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest, Neely Tucker, is currently a staff writer for The Washington Post. Neely, Vita, and Chipo Tucker live in Washington. The book, Love in the Driest Season, is published by Crown. Neely Tucker joins us this afternoon from Chicago, and in a moment or two, I'll have information about where you can see him while he's in the Chicago area. Neely Tucker, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Well, thanks for having me.
Sure. This book is about life and love and the power of love to transform us. To get underway, to begin, maybe you'd tell us about how you fell in love with the girl next door.
Well, I was living in downtown Detroit at the time, working for the Detroit Free Press. I had grown up in rural Mississippi during the 1960s and 70s. And after I lived in Detroit for a time, in a loft above a pizzeria, for those of you familiar with Detroit and the Greektown area, this astonishingly gorgeous woman moved in next door to me. And we were friends for 2 years before we thought of dating. She was 11 years older than myself. And we were just good friends for a long time. And then we got to be more than good friends. And displaying the average intelligence of most young men, I had to move 4,500 miles away to take up the paper's Eastern European posting to discover that the girl next door was the one for me. The complication in this, of course, is that this astonishingly gorgeous woman had grown up on the northwest side of Detroit during the Black Power and Motown days of that city, and so we were an interracial union that, as you might imagine, did not draw the approval of very many of my relatives.
Yeah. Now, as you say, at first glance, it would seem that you and Vita would not have had much in common. You know, a white guy from the rural South and an African-American woman from the city. But you were at once friends, at ease in one another's company. What were the things that drew you together?
Well, it's one of the ways in that race can play tricks on people in this country, and sort of the complex racial history of, particularly of the Deep South. Vita and I immediately had a lot in common because her people were up from a little town called Enterprise, Alabama. They had left Enterprise, Alabama for the same racial history that everyone is familiar with and came up north in the great migration of so many people that moved to Chicago, to Detroit, Cincinnati, Cleveland, places like that. But there is some sort of cultural overlap there between the Deep South and, in some ways, black culture. I wouldn't want to take this too far, understand, and but there is some odd cultural overlap, whether it's from food you eat to the pattern and pace of the language, that I found myself very much at home in downtown urban Detroit. Again, one wouldn't want to take this too far, and I want to make it clear that I had very definitely distanced myself from the racial attitudes that are commonly associated with Mississippi and the Deep South. I had left all that behind a long time ago, and by the time I moved in next door to Vita, I had, two tattoos, an earring, a ponytail, and a motorcycle. So I wasn't the typical guy from a small town of 2,000 in rural Mississippi by that point.
Yeah. Now, at this point, before you and Vita become a couple, what was your family's reaction to where you were living and the tattoos and the earring and the whole thing?
Well, they had pretty much been convinced by some of the above that I was already going to hell in a handbasket. there wasn't a lot of, you know, hope for me at that point. Fortunately, my parents saw Willie Nelson on live television once, and he had a diamond stud in his left ear. So that helped me out a little bit for a few minutes. But by the time I married Vita, they were no longer debating whether or not I was going to hell. It was just sort of what circle of hell I would wind up in.
Well, yeah. And a member of the media, too, on top of
that. Oh, yeah. You know, I have a long list of sins.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll get to how things have turned around there. In a few minutes here, I suspect. I want to get to this other critical love story, this other beautiful love story that involves love in the driest season, you and Vita falling in love with this tiny, very ill baby. Would it be fair to say it was love at first sight?
Absolutely. When we walked into the orphanage, again, this is some of the background is that I had roving post in Eastern and Western Europe and across the Mideast, and after 4 years of doing that assignment, I moved to take up the paper's Africa posting based out of Harare, the Zimbabwean capital. And over the course of 7 years, I wound up working in 50-something countries or territories on four continents, and I had often covered some very violent and chaotic situations. And that takes a toll, and that's part of what the book is about, some remarkable men who had changed my life that I met in very dire situations. But when we walked into Chinyarazzo, the orphanage to which Chipo had been brought, in the second crib on the right, as one walked in, buried beneath this forest of blankets, was this teeny tiny human being who was the most gorgeous thing I thought I had ever seen in my life. She had these long eyelashes that she seemed to blink in slow motion. She had these little toes that looked like erasers on the end of miniature pencils. And I just thought she was just stunningly beautiful. And I picked her up. She seemed to weigh just nothing at all. And again, at this point, we thought she was a newborn. And I had no experience with children. I had spent a lot of time in refugee camps, but none really with children. And so I just said, "Hey, pretty girl," and this didn't get a response. And I leaned down and bumped her nose with mine, and she blinked. And then she reached out, and as from the part of the prologue that you had read, mm-hmm. she wrapped her hand around my little finger. Mm-hmm. And I have not been the same man since.
Mm. And Vita fell in love, too.
Absolutely, from the maternal instinct. Then they explained to us, we turned to the staff and asked them about this adorable newborn. And they said, "Oh, no, she's 3 months old." At this point, Cheapo weighed 4.3 pounds. She had pneumonia for the third time. She'd been hospitalized for it twice before. She could neither smile nor giggle. She was almost completely non-responsive, and she was still losing weight. She looked like, in context, Zimbabwe was the world's AIDS capital at the time, and along with next-door neighbor Botswana still is, in an orphanage where a child died about every 3 weeks. She looked like the most HIV-positive child that, you know, a stereotypical idea of what an HIV-positive child looked like. That was her. And we just assumed for the longest that she was HIV-positive.
Yeah. And now she's been, as I understand, she's been tested and...
She has been tested many times. The book sort of moves in a couple of segments, and the first is just sort of keeping Cheapo alive.
Mm-hmm.
We had to rush her to the ICU, my wife did. We had brought her home for a trial weekend for 2 or 3 days, which was terrifying because she could barely breathe. We took her back to the orphanage on Sunday night, and I flew out of the country to go cover the beginnings of the Congolese Civil War on Monday morning, and Vito swung back by the orphanage on her way home just to check on her, and Cheapo was going into cardiac arrest. And Vito lifted her shirt, and she could just see her heart beating up against her rib cage. She was so small and emaciated. And Vita got the permission of the matron or director of the orphanage, rushed her to the hospital, where they gave absolutely no promises that she would survive the night, much less anything more than that. And 4 days later, after being in an oxygen tent in ICU, Cheapo was still alive, and the doctor said, asked Vita if she and I would be willing to bring her home, because to return her to the orphanage would be tantamount to a death sentence. And Vita said, of course. And that sort of sets the book into play, that it moves into a couple of different sectors of keeping Cheapo alive, mm-hmm. and then trying to complete an adoption in a country where, again, as you had read that passage, I and my colleagues were declared to be enemies of the state. But today, Cheapo is 5. She is perfectly healthy and happy. She has dreadlocks that comes down to her shoulders. She still has the same lovely little eyelashes. And she loves to sing Bob Marley. She has a karaoke machine, and you know, we had to hide the CD for a while. If I hear Three Little Birds one more time, which is the song Don't Worry About a Thing, because every little thing's going to be all right, that's her favorite.
Yeah.
So we had to hide that CD for a while.
Yeah. Now, what was it like the first few times you said, this is my daughter, I am a father?
Was under really very dramatic circumstances,
mm-hmm.
when I found out. As I had mentioned, Vita had brought her home, and I was in Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was facing an armed invasion by rebel forces at that point. A colleague and I were more or less beaten by a mob. Things were getting very tense, and then just to make things more interesting, the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and Dar es Salaam were bombed back in 1998. So we had to figure a way to get out of the city under armed rebellion and get over to Nairobi. This involved, you could go out to the airport and buy a ticket on the last plane out for $4,000. And you sort of did so with the idea that the rebels at that point were 12 miles from the airport. And so it was sort of an open bet that, okay, you can take off, but how high up are you going to get? Fortunately, they didn't shoot at the plane. We flew to Angola, and then to Brussels, Belgium, and then to London, and then caught a connecting flight to Nairobi, where I began covering the aftermath of the embassy bombing there, in which more than 220 people were killed, more than 4,000 were wounded. And I finally had a chance to call back home that night, and that was the night that Vita had brought Cheapo home. And it was under those conditions that I found out I had just become a father.
Hmm. And at this point in Nairobi, you met another man who was a father searching for his daughter.
It's one of the people who has had such a lasting impact on my life. It's the Reverend John Mungai, who was and still is pastor of the Apostolic Faith Church in Nairobi. And his daughter was studying at the secretarial school in the building just behind the embassy. And if you remember, the embassy actually sort of withstood the blast fairly well. It was the building behind it that just collapsed like a stack of pancakes. And Reverend Mungai's daughter, Margaret, was there. And after a couple of days of searching, it was pretty clear that she had not survived that. And I met him outside the very worst place to be, outside the morgue, which was where they were then bringing in body parts. If one has never been to a bombing scene, it's a little hard to describe how completely the human body can come apart. And they were just bringing in bits and pieces of people. Reverend McGuy would ultimately identify his daughter by her toenail polish. It was just a scene of mind-numbing carnage. And I had seen this very well-dressed, very well-composed man standing outside the entrance to the morgue where they would back these ambulances up with these parts in them. And I'd seen him there for a couple of days, so I went over and introduced myself. And he explained that he was a minister, and I just thought he was there consoling families and started to take my leave. And he said, no, I'm only here for Margaret. And he explained that that was his daughter. And he began talking in the present tense, as if she were still alive, that she's 20 years old, she's studying at the secretarial school, and she comes to me every night in my dreams, and I can hear her, but I cannot find her. And then he leaned over very close to me, almost nose to nose, and whispered so that nobody around us could hear. And he said, do you have children, Mr. Tucker? And this was just the day after I found out that Chipo had just come home with us. Mm. And I stammered for a second and said, well, yes, I do. And he said, how is your child? And I said, she's fine. I have a daughter. He said, how old is she? I said, she's not even one. He said, is she well? I said, she is beautiful. And he looked at me and he said, you should love her every day. Mm. And I think after he said that, it became clear to me that I was not going to be a foreign correspondent and be on the road 200 nights a year very much longer.
Yeah. A little earlier in the book, you write about seeing, as a reporter, seeing so many civilians, including, of course, children, in horrific conditions. Mm-hmm. But with Chipo, something changed in you. She pulled you back from the abyss. I believe you talk about you don't even know when your own emotional lights are dimming as a foreign correspondent. You see so much. Mm-hmm. But she really managed to pull you out. What a remarkable thing.
Well, it's again. It is, and I suppose it's one of the mysteries of love, that mm. why did we arrive there at that day, at that time? The doctor later told Vita if she had not gone by the orphanage, Chipo would have been dead within the hour. And this is not a book about how we saved a child's life in Africa. It's a book about how she saved mine.
Mm. You know, a number of years ago, I would have... If someone had suggested that you would have written that you would be writing a book about love and children and family life and transformation like this, I wonder what you would have, how you would have reacted.
Hopefully politely, but probably skeptically. We had moved abroad when we took our second posting. It was very clear to my wife and I that this was. We loved living abroad. I loved what I did. It was far more than just a job. As we had talked about, I'd grown up in a very small town in a very poor place and had really wanted to get out and see the world, and I had somehow found a way to make those childhood dreams come true. And essentially, I could go anywhere in the world I wanted to and write about more or less anything I wanted to. I thought it on an expense account. I thought it was just great. And I was very drawn to those... places of conflict where history was being written and where huge national and international issues were being decided. And one could be present at those situations and talk to the people on the ground. I just thought it was the most fascinating mm-hmm. way to work, and that you could make a living doing it. I thought was extraordinary. So after we took our second posting, we had all of our belongings shipped to Zimbabwe. We just had no intention of ever returning to the United States. And the idea that I would, a few years later, now be what my wife calls Mr. Mom, and be, you know, obsessively worried about, I get her up, Chipo up in the morning, get her ready for school, and, you know, it's a much tamer existence. My mornings are no longer figuring out how to get on the next plane out to, you know, to Baghdad, but of getting Cheapo to finish her juice and put on her jacket before we're late for school. Mm. I'm not conflicted at all, understand, but I would have thought it was highly unlikely.
Yeah. Well, back when you and Vita were in Harare living there, I don't think it was very long before you were volunteering in this orphanage. That seems to me a step forward right there, and it seems that Vita had perhaps ahead of Cheapo was leading you in a new direction in life.
Yeah, Vita is a very strong character in life. She's a very strong character in the book, and she had some time when I was traveling so much to look around a bit at things. And it was after about a year that we understood that the number of AIDS deaths in Zimbabwe were actual and not hyperbole. Zimbabwe at that point was a very stable, comparatively prosperous place. It was quiet. It was wonderful. And it was just sort of hard to believe that in a nation of 11 million people, that 500 people were dying of AIDS each week, every week, and that was sort of a minimum estimate. Nobody really knew, and nobody really knows to this day exactly what the death count is. But as of 1998, 2000, there were something like 600,000 Zimbabweans who had died in the, you know, since the disease was diagnosed. And it was about a year after being there that, after hearing every conversation with someone, was either going to a funeral or just coming back from a funeral, or their cousin or brother or sister or mother had just died of AIDS, that we began to think that these numbers were actual. So Vita had said on a trip when I came back, why don't we spend some time volunteering at an orphanage? And I thought that was an excellent idea. And so we were directed to a couple of places and we just had a very general idea. It had been explained to us that we couldn't adopt, that it was sort of against the law in Zimbabwe. You needed, as a foreigner, to actually adopt. You needed some, you know, mind-numbing array of approvals on up to the presidential cabinet. You had to have an exemption to the law, and you needed a presidential cabinet officer, the National Minister of Child Welfare, to personally sign an exemption to the law. So it was understood that we couldn't adopt, and so we just went down there with the vague right-handed idea that we would volunteer and do what we could while we were there. And the first day we were there, we met Cheapo.
Yeah. Would you tell us the story you tell very early in the book, in the first chapter, about your meeting with the official in Harare and the effect it had on you? Because I think this informs the story, in a sense, in terms of the politics of the situation, of the climate at the time when you're arriving there in
this
Zimbabwe.
This is with the immigration officer?
Yeah, Richard Tambadini.
Tambadini, who I came to think of as, as a pretty nice guy. Zimbabwe at that point was beginning its descent into where it is now, which is more or less an international pariah state. They've been, suspended from the Commonwealth, and all the heads of President Mugabe's administration have been barred from visiting a broad array of countries, mostly in Western Europe, the United States, Australia, and so forth. But at that point, in sort of official circles, there was just sort of this sullen hostility towards Americans in particular. They did not like, they didn't like the policies of the United States towards Africa, as they were perfectly entitled to do, and they were suspicious of American journalists. And the immigration officer took great umbrage that our goods had arrived there before we had. We had shipped them down from Poland, where we were before. And this crate arrives at more or less the same time we do, before I had been granted a work permit in that country. And he took great offense at this and interpreted it as this sort of deliberate racial slight that I, as this rich American man, just assumed that black Africans needed people like me. And so what he was going to do was impound my goods at the rate of, I believe it was $100 a day, for a period of months, before they might consider approving the paperwork. And I was stunned and had to explain to him that one apologized and explained that actually my newspaper was from the most predominantly black city in America, which was Detroit, and that the managing editor of that paper, who was a black American, the late Bob Magruder, had dispatched me there, and that we were, in fact, the only newspaper organization from the United States to stay in Zimbabwe after the fall of apartheid, when the rest of the Western Press Corps had decamped to South Africa, and we alone had stayed in a country that was 99% black. So I apologize for any offense that you might have taken, but I said so that we did so on the understanding that we had a very good relationship with the Zimbabwean government, and it certainly wasn't any sort of over-familiarity. We just thought we had a very good working relationship. And 2 days later, they approved the paperwork, but that was sort of a little warning bell to, that in the days ahead that I would remember that conversation very often.
Yeah. The AIDS epidemic in Africa, in particular in Zimbabwe, where you were, it has decimated the population. It has also affected Zimbabwean families in that there are, this is probably why Chipa was abandoned, there is no one to take care of the children.
Zimbabweans traditionally, like most of people in the sub-Sahara, the social welfare net, if you will, for children in crisis is the extended family. It's actually a marvelously well-functioning organism that takes care of almost everyone. It's down to, when I say the extended family, I mean second cousins, third cousins. There is one's family totem, or sort of an extended family clan, and as long as you're in the totem, you have someone to care for you. The problem with the AIDS crisis is that so many young parents have died, people between the ages of 25 and 44, that there are so few parents now who can take care of children in crisis, whether they're abandoned by because of HIV or just repercussions from it. To give you some idea of both things, one, about 1 in 4 people between the ages of 25 and 44 in Zimbabwe is thought to be HIV positive. The mortality rate for that age group in Harare between 1990 and 2000 was up 700% in a decade. On the other hand, in the number of children who were taken in by either collectives or extended family members, there's an example quoted in the book in one rural area, it's about 95%. But the numbers are such that that 5% that's abandoned amounts to hundreds of children. So that's where you have a crisis in the orphanages, that you just have so many children who were abandoned under mysterious circumstances that they are very hard-pressed to keep up. In one province, the state newspaper had reported, it's very hard to get definite numbers on any number of things, but the government-run newspaper had reported that at one point in Zimbabwe has 11 what you call provinces, or we'd call states, and that in 1 6-month period in one province alone, there had been 91 children who had been left in fields or slipped into sewers or thrown into trash dumps. 91 in that 6-month period alone. That should give you some idea of the numbers and the need that's there.
Yeah. And the orphanage where you volunteered, they were working with 30 cents a day per child.
Yeah, and that later, from inflation, went down to around 10 or 12 cents to feed, clothe, house, treat, nurture, educate each child in the ward. There were about infants at any one time. It could, you know, kids under two, let's call it. There could be at any one time at this one particular orphanage that we were most familiar with, there could be anywhere from 10 to 25 at one time. It was in a fairly good-looking facility. The problem that you'd notice is that, you know, almost each time he came back, another child had died. And in the 24 months that we were there, 35 children in that age range died. And some went out to other family members who, you know, learned of their presence, or they had just been placed there for a while during a crisis period. But an extraordinary number were abandoned with no one.
Mm. Well, tell us about Stella Messicano and the other folks there at the orphanage, at the children's home, how did they try to cope with such a situation?
I thought they did an absolutely remarkable job, and part of the book is actually dedicated or in the acknowledgments to the daisy chain of people who kept Chipo alive and who kept other children alive on just a pittance of a salary. Stella was the matron or the director of Chinirazzo. And as we mentioned, she had an astonishing little amount of money to try and keep up with a broad number of children, many of them special needs, many of them in very dire circumstances. And she was left to sort of be the fundraiser to get other funds to come in. She also had a staff that was, there were many older women there who did terrific work, and there were a number of younger women who, over time, it sort of became clear to us, were simply older orphans who had grown up there themselves. And they were working for the equivalent of room and board, and at that point, the equivalent of $5 US a month, or $60 a year. They were very sweet, and they cared. But there's obviously they had no intense neonatal training of special needs infants, so there was only so much they could do. And this led to a number of probably preventable deaths, but I certainly would never, ever want to point a finger at the few people who were there doing something to help as a cause for that. To give you an idea of one of the most wrenching examples to us, and for me this is one of the most difficult passages that I wrote about, was there was a little boy named Robert who was just adorable. His situation was almost identical to Chipo. He'd been abandoned at birth. Chipo had been abandoned beneath an acacia tree in the rural areas on the day she was born. Umbilical cord still attached. Hundreds of ants eating her umbilical cord. They were beginning to eat her right ear when she was discovered quite by chance by a passerby. Robert had a similar history. Vita had met him while I was working in Nigeria and had called me about him and said she wanted to bring him to the house, but she couldn't because of how special needs Chipo was, and she wanted me to come home right away. And I promised to cut this trip I was on short and come home as quickly as I could. The next day, Robert became very ill, and he was dispatched to the hospital with one of the young women at the orphanage. And she tied him to her back, as was the traditional method of transport, and took him to the emergency room. But she was so timid and so shy, and she sat in the waiting room for such a long period of time, that when the doctor finally called her name and she took Robert off her back, he was dead. That was very difficult to live with. It still is. It's very difficult to write about, and is just one of the saddest occasions I know of that we came across.
Yeah. Well, the situation in Zimbabwe is in crisis, this political crisis, and the U.S. announced new economic sanctions last week, the first week of March 2004, and there have been reports of hunger, even among farmers. How is this political crisis, how are sanctions affecting the families of Zimbabwe, particularly the children?
The sanctions that the U.S. announced this past week were sort of a slap at some of senior members of Mugabe's government. They don't apply to the general population.
Okay.
They just apply to the farms and business enterprises of, I believe it's 7 or 8 senior members of Mugabe's administration. Zimbabwe has at the moment a number of problems to deal with. There was recently a cholera epidemic in the north, as has gotten a lot of press. President Mugabe wanted to settle the land question in Zimbabwe, which is the fact that 20 years after Rhodesia became Zimbabwe, you still had about 4,000 white farmers who owned about 50% of all the available farmland in the country. President Mugabe's idea of dealing with this was to just, quote-unquote, take back the land from the farmers. As it turned out, at gunpoint, that's the overlay to the situation. In reality, Zimbabweans understand it to be far more complicated than that. It's an issue about Zimbabwe becoming a totalitarian state, where Mugabe is unwilling to countenance any criticism of him or his party. at all. And it's very clear within Zimbabwe. Most Zimbabweans have very little sympathy for white farmers. However, they are cognizant that those farms were exporting farms and produced about 30% of the national economy, which has since pretty much, if not totally wrecked, then close to decimated. The tourist industry and the resulting violence around the farms has dropped 90%. That applied to about, that was occurring or was gaining about 30% of Zimbabwe's foreign currency reserves. And to put it in most contexts, Zimbabwe is 99% black. Mugabe had put an issue, a constitutional referendum, that we want to just change the constitution so that we can take the land from these white farmers at will and not have to pay them for it. His party owned 147 out of 150 seats in parliament. They own the only national TV station, the only national radio, and the only national newspaper. And they lost that election. And they lost it badly. That was the election that in the book we could see coming up, that it was clear that he was going to lose that election. It was clear that since he had already declared foreign correspondents to be enemies of the state, that our status there was going to be very tenuous. And so we had to get out of the country before that election took place.
Yeah. What were those final days, weeks like for you?
It was very tense. By that point, this is, for keeping track on the calendar, this is late 99-2000. There had been a couple of Zimbabwean journalists who had already been, it's not that they were arrested by the military, they were kidnapped by the military, and held and tortured for several days over the objections of the country's Supreme Court. Their sin was that they had reported an alleged coup attempt against President Mugabe. And his response to this debacle that followed and how it was handled was to go on national television and not seek to calm the population, but to inform them that there were certain people who were treasonous and that they were enemies of the state. And those people primarily were white farmers. They were independent Zimbabwean journalists who would dare to criticize his regime. And they were, of course, all foreign correspondents, of which there were only a very few in the country. So we had a definite timeline that we were working against to work through the restrictions on adoption. And then as an enemy of the state, to want to be granted that adoption and then get out before this election took place. I swear I make the analogy, it's sort of like if you were the only Al Jazeera correspondent in the United States and you wanted to adopt a blonde-haired, blue-eyed child, and the only thing you needed to get that done was to have John Ashcroft's signature. That was sort of what we were looking at trying to complete.
Yeah. Boy. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, journalist Neely Tucker. He's currently a staff writer for The Washington Post. He and his wife, Vida, adopted a Zimbabwean girl named Chipo. Her name in the Shona language means gift. And Shona is the language spoken by the majority of Zimbabweans. The Tuckers went to live in Zimbabwe in 1997. Neely Tucker was a foreign correspondent covering Africa for the Detroit Free Press. He has written a memoir, a family memoir is what he calls it, Love in the Driest Season. The book is published by Crown. He's joining us this afternoon from Chicago. Tonight, March 8th, 2004, at 7 o'clock tonight, he'll be at Transitions Book Place on 1000 West North Avenue in Chicago. And then tomorrow, on the 9th of March, 2004, he'll be at Anderson's in Naperville. That's 123 West Jefferson in Naperville. That event also set for 7 o'clock in the evening. The time is flying by, and before we run out of time, I want to talk about Chipo and the effect she's had on your larger family. Tell us about that.
Sure. Well, she's has done a remarkable job at even at a pre-verbal stage of bringing our two families together. As we had said at the top of the hour, my family was not amused at our interracial marriage, but as it turns out, I am the son of an abandoned child. My father was left by his father as an infant in rural Mississippi, and he grew up amid, I suppose, great turbulence and moving around. a good bit in Depression-era Mississippi with his mom and another man that she later married and then divorced. But I didn't know any of that when I was growing up. I just thought the people who I thought were my grandparents, I suppose, were my former step-grandfather and his second or third wife. It was never really clear to me quite what that was. But my father had, I'd just seen him call this this man, Pete Gasaway, Daddy, all of my life. And so I thought he was my grandfather. I was only about 15, when I was 15 or 16, that I learned that that wasn't, at least biologically speaking, quite true. By that point in my life, it was a distinction without a difference. And my father just never mentioned the man who had abandoned him and who was his biological father. He just thought there was no reason to ever mention him to anyone. And when he found out that Vita and I had adopted an abandoned child, race, he sort of seemed to forget about race, it seemed to us. And this was a guy who hates to go north of Memphis or east of Tuscaloosa. he had never left the United States before. And long before Chipa was adopted, I mean, this was a week or two after we brought her home, she was had just arrived at home with us. He applied for an expedited passport. He and my mother flew 38 elapsed hours to get to Zimbabwe so that they could see, at that point, their only grandchild. And he dotes on her, as does my mother, flies up four times a year to see her. Yeah. She spends more time talking to Vita than she does either of my brothers and I, or my brother and I. And Chipo goes home each summer for, in the old Southern tradition, for a week or two to spend with her grandparents. She calls my father Big Daddy. when she wants ice cream after dinner and she knows she's not supposed to have it, it's Mr. Big Daddy.
Mr. Big Daddy.
And he's turned into a complete punk. he just turns him out. And they just have a fabulous relationship.
Well, that's great. He hasn't gone yet for the earring yet, though.
Right. No, I wouldn't want to go that far. You can only get or the tattoos or the motorcycle. But he so clearly he doesn't say much. He's sort of a very reserved figure.
Right.
But he so clearly dotes on Chipo. Before she came down the very first time, he worked out in his shop he has outside the they don't have a working farm anymore, but the shop he has out back of the house to build her a swing set. He bought her a bicycle so that for the week she was there, she would have a bike to ride. He takes her to swimming lessons each day when she's down there. They just have a great time.
Yeah. Now, what does Chipo know of her story?
She knows, within reason for a five-year-old, she knows all of it. She certainly knows that that she's adopted, and she knows what that means. And she knows that she was very sick in the hospital when Mommy and Daddy came to find her. And she refers to the book as the Chipo book, and she knows that it's about how we became a family, which is exactly what it is.
Yeah. Last month, in February of 2004, National Public Radio did a piece on the family for All Things Considered. Mm-hmm. I want to let our listeners know that it's still on the NPR website. If they go to npr.org, they can hear Michelle Norris's lovely story on you. And there are pictures there, and you can actually hear Chipo's voice there as well. So for listeners this afternoon, you might want to check that out. npr.org, go to the All Things Considered Features Archive, and you'll see the family there.
I thought you were going to be able to hear her voice earlier in this interview. She was running around downstairs at the moment. I believe one of her aunties reminded her that she needed to be a little quieter for an hour. She's playing with her cousin Jay today and having a blast.
Great, great. Well, I wish you all the best. You and Vita and Chipo and Big Daddy and the whole family on both sides.
Thank you very much, ma'am.
You're very welcome. A pleasure to talk with you this afternoon. Our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine has been Neely Tucker. Look for his book, Love in the Driest Season, a Family Memoir. It is published by Crown. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time, and settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Another fun day for the traders in Chicago. They were busy again today at the Board of Trade across the grains floor, where corn futures broke by about 4 cents. The wheat were down 6, and the beans in the nearby contract off 22 and a quarter. That November was down 9 3/4. We'll take a complete look at the highs, the lows, and settlements now from the Board of Trade. The March futures in the wheat pit, 364 on the high for the day. The low at 360, a settlement price at 360 and a quarter, down 6 and a quarter. May futures, 371 and a half, the high. The low at 365 and a half. And a settlement price at 367 and three quarters. They were down 6. Most of this is just a continuation of some technical selling that happened last week, as they dropped about 11 cents from the week before on Friday. Friday closes last week. July futures in the wheat pit, 374 and a half, the high. The low at 370. Settlement price at 371 and a half. They were down 6 cents. September futures, 378 and a half, the high. The low at 375. A settlement price, 375 and a quarter, down 7 and a quarter. And December futures in the wheat pit, 387 and a half, the high. The low at 384, settlement price at 386. They finished down 5 3/4. March corn off 4 cents today, 288 and a half. The high, the low at 285. A settlement price, 286 and a half. Once again, that March contract settling 4 lower. The May futures, 294 and a half. The high, the low at 291. A settlement at 292 and a half, down 4 3/4. July futures for the corn, 298. The high, the low at 294 3/4. A settlement price, 296 and a quarter, down 4 3/4. In September futures, 292 the high, the low at 288 3/4. A settlement there, 290 and a half, down 4 1/4. Now the December contract, 289 the high, the low at 285 and a half. A settlement price at 287 and a quarter, down 4 1/4. And the March corn, 289 and a half, high, low at 287. A settlement at 288 and a quarter, down 4 1/4. July futures of 05 for the corn, 292 and a half, the high, the low at 290. A settlement price there at 290, down a nickel for the day. And the December 05 corn, this is two crop years out, 265 and a half, the high, the low at 263. A settlement price at 265, and they finished unchanged on the day. The March oats, 153 3/4 for the high, the low at 151 3/4. Settlement price there, 152. They were down a quarter. And the May oats, 158 3/4, the high, the low at 154 3/4. The settlement, 156. They finished up 3/4 for the day. From the soy complex, the nearby March contract down 22 1/4. That on the idea is that there is more bird flu on the east coast of the United States, and that would put quite a crimp in the bean meal and actually in corn domestic usage numbers. Apparently, according to some sources in Chicago, anyway, futures managed to move 22 cents lower in that nearby March contract, 924 1/4, the high, the low at 903, a settlement price at 911 1/2, and at 911 1/2, that is, rather. And once again, it finished down 22 1/4. The May futures, 928 1/2 on the high, the low at 908, settlement price there, down 20 3/4 cents at 917. We'll talk with Kurt Kimmel at 6 after the hour, 2 o'clock this afternoon, during the closing market report. We'll ask him whether it was just bird flu or there's something else in this market, and whether he thinks it's topping. July futures in the bean pit, 917 the high, the low at 899, a settlement price at 907 1/2. It finished 18 1/2 lower. In the September soybeans, 803 the high, the low at 795. Finished $8.50, down 11. Now the November contract, 732 the high, the low at 723. Those Novembers holding pretty steady given the 22-cent drop in the nearbys. They were just down 9 3/4, 729 1/2, the settlement price for the Novembers. January beans, 731 the high, low at 723, a settlement price at 726, 11 1/4 lower. In the March beans, 726 the high, the low at 719. Settled 7.24. They were down 9 1/2 cents. The March bean meal for the day, 281.50 the high, the low at 276. The settlement price at 279.30, down 4.50. In the May meal, 283 on the high, the low at 277. A settlement price, 279.40, down 6.20. March bean oil, 32.60 for the high, the low at 31.92. And a settlement price at 32.20, down 54. The May futures, 32.47 in the bean oil pit on the high side, the low at 31.75. And that settlement price at $32.04 for the May bean oil was 63 lower. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, let's find those numbers from the Merc, and it looks like it was a mixed day today. We'll call it mixed today on the Mercantile Exchange. March feeder cattle, 88 even the high, 87.15 the low, 87.40 the settlement, that up 10. April, 85.90 the high, 84.80 the low, 84.90 the settlement, that down 35. May, 86 even the high, 84.80 the low, 85.02 1/2 the settlement, that down 80. August, 87.95 the high, 86.85 the low, $87.22.5 the settlement, that down 70. March live cattle, 82 even the high, 81.50 the low, 81.50 the settlement, that up 5. April, 80.10 the high, 79 even the low, 79.05 the settlement, that down 17.5. June live cattle, 74.80 the high, 74.32.5 the low, 74.57.5 the settlement, that up 25. August live cattle, 73.50 the high, 72.80 the low, 73 even the settlement, that down 15. April lean hog, 62.67.5 the high, 61.05 the low, 61.20 the settlement, that down 72.5. May, 62.50 the high, 61.30 the low, 61.70 the settlement, that down 40. June lean hog, 67.95 the high, 66.60 the low, 67.50 the settlement, that up 10. July lean hogs, 64 even the high, 62.75 the low, the settlement 63.67.5, that up 10. March bellies, 97.05 the high, 95.40 the low, 96.60 the settlement, that up 97.5, and May pork bellies, 98.30 the high, 96.70 the low, finishing at 97.35, so May bellies finished 80 higher today on the Mercantile Exchange. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is 10,570, down 25. The NASDAQ is down 30 points at 2018. The S&P 500 down 6 points at 1151.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering Baltic bakery bread, caviar, and baklava. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Melanie Johnson from Blentville, Tennessee writes, "Dear Dr. Science, I would like to know why sloths are so misunderstood. I would also like to know why they only have 2 or 3 toes. Why can't people just learn to love sloths for who they are? A sloth is a noble creature that just wants a chance to live in peace and harmony with mankind. Why can't you people get a life and learn to love sloths? A sloth is just one of God's creatures who happens to be but ugly."
Yeah, I think you have me confused with your therapist or someone else who cares about your feelings. Good luck finding such a person. And remember, feelings are not facts.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI, Public Radio International. For information about the new Dr. Science Get Smart Kit, including his new compact disc with screensaver for PCs and an honorary master's degree mouse pad, all for $21.95, call 800-989-9789.